Welcome to Too Much Perspective. I'm your host, Mike Brizgota, coming to you from the greatest city in the world, Chicago, Illinois. And I'm here today with Chris Green, who is a saxophonist, leader of the Chris Green Quartet, and is generally known as the future emperor of Evanston. Thanks for being here, Chris.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
This is really cool, actually, for me, because when I was in my early 20s, going around Chicago, seeing bands, going to clubs, Chris Green was in every single band that I saw in the entire city. And Green Mill, Shubas, Nevins, Fitzgeralds, and, you know, you were one of those people that was just on the scene, and everybody was like, that's Chris. If there's a saxophonist in your band and you're playing at a certain level, Chris Green is your saxophonist.
You know, that's kind of funny, because I guess I never realized how much I was actually working at the time. And never mind that I probably wasn't playing very well.
Well, I don't think that's the case.
But yeah, I guess that is weird. I guess we have a mutual friend. Kevin O'Donnell. And he kept me employed for a fairly long time throughout the late 90s and early 2000s.
So. Yeah, and that's about that time. And it was cool. And then, you know, several years later, now we've gotten to work together. And it's been kind of an interesting, cool thing. Like, when you meet those people that are, you know, on the scene before you are, and then you get to work with them. Did you get to experience that when you were coming up?
Kind of, sort of. I mean, I guess it was always one of my, I always made it a point to just, like, you know, for lack of a better term, I guess I'm a jazz musician, but I like all kinds of stuff, and I've always wanted to play all kinds of stuff. And, you know, like I said, like we were talking about Kevin, like, of all people, I met him through a friend of mine that was going to school at Northwestern University, who ran kind of a funky Steely Danish kind of cover band. Mm-hmm. And so he hired me for a bunch of stuff, and then he actually got contracted to run the pit orchestra for a production of Hair at Northwestern. Kevin was the drummer, actually. And so we hit it off really well, and he said, like, you know, and you hear all the time, like, I've got this project coming up and I want to hire you for such and such. And I'm like, oh, all
right. Sure, whatever. You do, right?
Yeah, whatever. You know, the swing band, all right, whatever. And then he called me up, and like I said, we worked together for a long time. I always wanted to play all kinds of stuff, and I learned from all kinds of everything that I play with, or every band that I play with, or every musician I play with, I get to learn something. So it's always a good time.
No, it is. And it's, I mean, you still do, like, beyond leading your own quartet, which we'll talk about in a little bit, you are playing with everybody, all kinds of jazz. I see you listing on jazz things, R&B, rock and roll, you know, productions and that type of thing. How does that affect your band leading?
I guess I never wanted to really put any rules in my own band. And I guess, you know, again, for lack of a better term, I am a jazz musician, and I've studied this history and blah, 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 and all that stuff. But, again, the saxophone has a pretty rich history in, like, R&B and, you know, rock and roll solos, you know, Clarence Clemons, sure, playing with the Boss, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, there's the saxophone's everywhere. And so, you know, for one thing, not every gig is going to be the ideal jazz gig. Sometimes you're going to have to, like, you know, walk the bar, so to speak, you know, and play the growly stuff. Just, you know, and sometimes, you know, I like that. I actually like doing that. I like the fact that I can play a jazz gig one night here in Chicago and then play with, like, the Jay Davis Trio, the hip-hop band, mm-hmm, the next night or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I like that. I mean, I like kind of like that versatility. But I guess, I mean, I just, how does that affect my band? Like, I guess, again, I learned something from every experience I'm in. I mean, even, like, playing with Jay Davis Trio, like, I work a lot with, it's a band, they've been around for at least 20 years.
Oh yeah.
They've been around for a long time. And I think I've been playing with them for, like, the past 5 or 6 years. And so I've gotten to record with them a few times on the last few albums. And it's weird, like, Julio Davis has a pretty unique songwriting approach. He's not a musician per se. His dad is Carl Davis, the legendary Chicago producer.
That's right.
And it's weird, like, he's not a musician per se, but although he can kind of, like, play out his ideas on, like, keyboards and vibraphone, and then he'll either keep the idea that he comes up with, or he'll bring somebody in to replay the idea. But, you know, it's like, he was putting a song together, and he was literally, like, taking he was taking almost like live sampling. Like he would like play a bass line on the keyboard from like some obscure soul song, and then he would play the vibraphone part from another part, mm-hmm. and it just kind of like, you know, he's literally, you know, we talk about people who put together in disparate influences, but he's actually literally playing parts of songs, you know, and seeing how they work against each other.
Yeah, the, like the live mashup type of
right, right. And, yeah. And it just kind of like, and that kind of thing had a kind of profound influence on my own songwriting. And I guess I was kind of doing that anyway, but just to see somebody else in another discipline do it, mm-hmm. it was just kind of like, okay, you know, that's something else to try. So, yeah. So I mean, I kind of on my previous album, the live album, Group Effort. The first song is called "A Bride of Mr. Congeniality." The B section essentially is basically a straight up ripoff of Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes' "Bad Luck." Like,
yeah,
like the from the chord progression to the bass line is pretty much a straight up bite. But just that kind of thing where you can actually like make reference to another song, and that pretty savvy people, musically savvy people, will get it and get the reference, and they'll be, "Oh my God, I see where you got that from." Mm-hmm. Most people don't really care,
right?
You know, they just think, "Oh, that's really cool how you did that." But you know, the really savvy people will be like, "Oh man, that was really cool how you did that." So, you know, so just that little things like that kind of influence, you know, my band leading and mm-hmm. arranging. And again, just the fact that, also the fact that, and I always say this all the time, like it's 2014. I grew up in the 80s. You know, I grew up kind of in the advent of MTV. So pretty much, you know, it's not New York in 1945. It's not, you know, Miles Davis playing in California in 1969, 1970. You know, in addition to all this rich history of jazz, there's a shitload of other history that there's a bunch of other music that I've grown up listening to, and it's just, I just see no reason to like not use that,
right? Not acknowledge that, yeah.
Not acknowledge it, not use it. You know, if it's good music or something that I can use to better express what I need to express, then, you know, if it's a funk rhythm or a Brazilian rhythm or whatever, it's pretty much all good. So that's how I kind of I feel about all that.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a, I mean, it's, I think like sometimes, I know like in music school, the jazz kids got really snobby about jazz and were like, yeah, we're like, they were living in 1950 when bebop was, and it was like the only thing that was legit was bebop. But you're right, like we all grew up way after bebop.
Absolutely.
After our parents stopped listening to people, you know what I mean? Like, and like, you know, we grew up with, you know, Michael Jackson and Prince and the Police and all these bands that like have all these, even if you didn't listen to them, they're going on
right
at the shopping mall, in your car, in your friend's car, at the restaurant, you know?
And I guess, you know, I've had my moments, at least when I went away to music school, I had my moments of musical snobbiness just when I was trying to get my stuff together.
Well, you have to like, I mean, because you're still, you're training for
developing
it.
And yeah. Getting together, but I guess the thing that we forget, the funny thing is, like, we forget a bunch of things. Again, like I said, it's not 1945. Mm-hmm. We also forget that, you know, Coltrane played with an R&B band when he was getting his stuff together.
That's right.
I just read Thelonious Monk biography that came out a couple years ago, and apparently he toured with this kind of like traveling gospel kind of review for like 6 months or so.
Interesting.
So it's just like, you know, it's just like little things like that that are just kind of like off the grid,
yeah,
so to speak, that, you know, that you use in your own personal conception. It's just, you know, Miles was really into classical music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Charlie Parker apparently wanted to really, really study orchestration. You know,
right.
He had this kind of like, you know, love of classical music. So like, we all have other interests outside of our chosen discipline, genre, whatever, and it's funny. Like even the kids, the other jazz students that I went to school with, they were all pretty open minded. It was just a really interesting thing. It was just like, I like this other stuff, but I just never play it. It just kind of,
yeah,
like,
right. And it seems to be like, you know, you're above it or something, like,
right.
Which is interesting because like when jazz came out, you know, jazz was sort of like the music of, you know,
right. It was a dance music.
Exactly,
you know,
right.
I guess, you know, again, the funny thing about it is people forget, you know, it is this, you know, America, people like to put these, you know, America's true art form and all this stuff. remember, of course, it was played in, it was gestated in New Orleans brothels and kind of came to fruition in like Kansas City after hour spots.
Roadhouses, yeah, exactly.
Roadhouses, right. And Chicago speakeasies, yep. And all this other stuff. You know, it went, you know, it's got this history of being, you know, and jazz itself, the name is kind of, isn't it kind of a play on a sex act or something?
Exactly, right, yeah.
So, you know, we're trying to add dignity to a music that's kind of already dignified, but it also has this really kind of dirty history to
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
You know, which is as it should be. So it's just like, it's jazz can, it's everything and it's everywhere and it's influenced everything, but it's also just got this history of like, you know, and again, the musicians themselves, they're more diverse. The people that we love and admire and all this stuff, they're, you know, they're as diverse as we like to think we are, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. and it just seems to kind of silly to be like, go after this pure jazz thing when, you know, every good musician that we like has fused plenty of things together. Both, you know, in their head or in the, you know, in the bandstand or whatever. I guess we just forget that and just try to, you know, this jazz is this and everything.
It's right,
just,
right,
you
right.
know, if that's the way you want to feel, cool, but it just it's better to me to like collaborate with people that are, you know, that listen to jazz but also listen to other stuff.
Right,
so
right.
So then we can make reference to other stuff.
Exactly, well, so. Right. It is all those things, but it's not only those things, right. You know. And then yeah, if you want to go see it at the CSO, at Symphony Hall, you want to see the Dave Brubeck Quartet play. Well, not anymore, but, you know, right. You could see that and everybody sits quietly and claps, or you can still go to, you know, some club and check it out.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
You made a reference, and this is similar to what we're talking about. I promise I had no plan on this, but in the liner notes for your new record, you talk about playing in a band called The Truth. That was sort of, you know, you were making reference to fusing those styles and also, you know, just in growing up, when you grew up, where you grew up, and that type of thing.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Evanston, and it was this band of, it's funny, like, when I became serious about playing, like, okay, this is what I want to do. I was a senior in high school, mm-hmm. and I was on my way out, and then there was a group of three freshmen on the way in that were in the music program that Evanston has. These three really, really badass musicians. It was John Berry on guitar, Gabe Shuford on keyboards, and I want to say Chris Fickus on bass. And four badasses. Chris Fickus on bass and this guy named Noah Sheldon on drums. And they were, I think they had all gone to middle school together, and they were all just incredibly, like, these four, like, prodigy dudes that just, like, in addition to being really serious musicians, they had the foresight to, like, they got together, they rehearsed all the time, and they actually were like pressing up like tapes, like what high school,
exactly,
what freshman or eighth grader in high school does this, has the foresight to like press up gigs and book little shows at churches and sell them to like
at the merch table, right? Yeah, exactly.
And to have a merch table at like eighth grade and 14 years old, like who does that?
Exactly, right.
So, but you know, so that was really cool. But then into like, but the three of them were actually in the jazz program, and I was in the jazz band, and mm-hmm. I was like Mr. Hot Shit Senior.
Sure.
So we hit it off, and they asked me to play with them, and again, this is when I was just starting to get serious, and I was just kind of like grabbing for like things to do and everything, and it just, I think this was about the time that I guess Dream of the Blue Turtles came out, and
right,
you know, there was this big to do about Branford Marsalis playing with Sting and everything, and I just thought it was so cool that this guy, this really high profile badass musician, was also playing this like super hip pop stuff at the time, mm-hmm. So, and that's kind of what they modeled themselves after,
sure,
and so I was kind of getting to play these little, again, keep in mind, I was only 17 and not very good, but at least, but I guess they thought I was pretty good. And so I was playing with them, and they were playing with me. It was fun. I remember it was a lot of fun. It was like my first real professional experience was like playing with these guys.
Right, right, you know, right.
I'm a senior playing with these like badass freshmen.
Right, so, right, right. Yeah, you were showing them the ropes. And now you lead your own band, the Chris Green Quartet.
Yep.
You guys have been around for a while now.
Yeah. Our first gig was in 2005, so we're I can't count. Is that 8 years? No, 9 years.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. 9 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's pretty, I mean, I think it's pretty unique for any jazz quartet to have the same personnel for, even two records, but, you know, a long period of time. Like, how do you guys do that?
We've managed a while. I mean, we've only had one personnel change and then the whole time. Steve Corley, our drummer, mm-hmm. He joined in 2011. Before that, it was a guy named Tyrone Blair. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, you know, it's just, it's a pretty unique experience. I guess for me, it was always like you would go see your favorite player or whatever in town. And every time you would go see him, it would be a different band.
Right.
And their head would be, like, they'd have this great music, but everybody's head would be, like, buried in the sheet music.
Right,
and
right.
So, you know, so there's no looking around. There's no real interaction. They're just, everybody's just kind of, like, just trying to get through the chord changes and the forms and everything without screwing up.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I wanted a band of people that I could make music with. I mean, all the people we like. Miles and Mingus and Duke Ellington, they had bands for years.
Right.
And that was just kind of one of my goals to, like, you know, pick musicians that were diverse enough to draw upon a bunch of stuff. So, like, Damian Espinosa, he's been in my band. We had another band before the quartet, but I've been working with him since about 2000. Mark Piani, the bass player, I've actually been playing with him since about 96.
Mm-hmm.
And then Steve, I've actually known him since about 99, 2000, whatever. He was always like our first call sub. And so when I was thinking about making the change for drummers, he was the first guy I thought of. So, but really, just at least for me, as far as keeping the band together, I guess I'm lucky enough to have guys that are really committed to the project. I don't think I micromanage anything. I mean, I figure if you hire people to do what they do, and then at the end of the day, I have the final say of, like, you know, maybe do this one more time, or maybe, you know, I have the final say over the whole thing.
Sure.
But I you know, there's nothing I can tell Damian about playing the piano.
Right, right. He's going to bring his own
thing.
He's
a much better piano player than I could ever hope to be. All I can tell him is what I'd like to hear in this framework, or what I'd like to hear in this particular song. There's nothing I can tell Mark about playing the bass. There's nothing I can tell Steve about playing the drums. Only thing I have to tell someone like Steve is, like, pretend that Max Roach and Questlove had a baby and he started playing drums and he threw the drums down the stairs.
Right, right.
Backwards. You know, that's the,
right.
And then Steve will think about it for like 5 seconds and be, okay, I see what you want.
Yeah, I got it.
And he'll play it, you know. So it's that kind of thing, you know. And just, you know, I hire them because I want them to do what they do. And I want them to bring what they bring to the tunes and the arrangements that we do. And plus, everybody writes for the band, and everybody kind of, again, I have the final say because it's my band, but
sure.
But everybody has a say in the arrangement. You know, like, I'll write stuff, but for some reason, I can never really end my song. I don't know how to end songs.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark, my bass player, is, like, really good at coming up with endings, mm-hmm. like really potent endings. Somebody else will write something, but I'll say, like, maybe we could change the rhythm up a bit or whatever. Mm-hmm. So everyone's got a little bit of a say, and
yeah, and that trust factor and that
song,
type of
you
thing.
Know, in the song. So that's what I appreciate about the band that I work with.
Yeah, it's cool. Like, I feel like once you've been playing, if you've been able to survive long enough playing, generally everyone you know can play. So then you have, like, this advantage of choosing people you like and people you get along with, and, like, that makes the whole difference, right?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think about that. Like, there are other bands that I've played with that there's always some, you know, the music will be good, but then there'll be some weirdness between some people, like people in the band, or sometimes, like, you really get, there are other situations where I've really gotten along with a lot of people in the band, but just the music's just not very fulfilling or just whatever. Hell, I was actually talking about this with a friend of mine. A couple years ago, I played with this. I shouldn't say the name of the band. I won't say the name of the
band. Yeah, we're still starting out here, so
I won't say the name of it. I won't say the name of it. What I'll say was that the concept was it was a percussion player, a DJ. It was me, another saxophone player, a trumpet player, and I'm trying to think. Yeah, that was it. Yeah, that was the band. And the concept of the percussionist was the leader.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't really much of a percussionist per se, but he knew what to do. He knew how to hit his congas. But this whole thing was like, the DJ would play records, and then the three of us would improvise. The horn players would improvise over the, you know, everybody in the band was fine.
Sure.
The horn players were great. The other saxophone player is one of my best friends. But we played this gig in Ohio, like this like outdoor, kind of like their version of like the Taste of Chicago, like
okay.
This big, huge outdoor arts fest and everything. It was great. We got paid very well. They treated us like kings. Everything, everybody got along. It was so much fun, but the music, it sucked.
Yeah,
at least to me. Like
yeah,
but everybody was dancing. Like we were basically playing over.
Over somebody else's record.
Exactly. And so the percussionist was like looking at us like, come up with something. And like, you realize there are horns on this song already.
Yeah, I think they did a pretty good job with
like,
whatever.
They don't need us.
Exactly.
Like, oh, just keep playing. It sounds great. And it was just, but it was weird. Like, everything was great except for the gig. The hang was great.
Uh-huh.
Talking, you know, we had a good time just talking.
Yeah.
Talking, all kinds of stuff. It was great. But just like, once we... It's like, oh man, we actually have to step on stage now.
Yeah,
like,
right. Sucks. It's not like, just hanging out.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, oh man. So my point is like this is a situation for me where like, you know, everybody in the band is committed to the project, everybody knows the music, everybody's taking the time to like practice and bring themselves to the music. It's
the best of both worlds,
yeah,
then, right? Like
yeah.
you get along with each other,
and, like
yeah.
I said, and we get along. We,
yeah,
and we get along. We're friends outside of this as well. So
it's
a lot of fun. So
cool.
I'm lucky in that sense.
Well, let's take a listen to a little bit of the Institutional Samba. This is from your guys' newest record, Music Appreciation, right?
Yeah.
The Institutional Samba from the Chris Green Quartet, and that is one of your own compositions, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's one I wrote.
Yeah. So, and you know, so you wrote this in B major. I was reading in the.
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't check it, but I trusted the liner notes.
Yes. Very, very good. Yes, I wrote it in. I don't know why I did that.
Yeah, it's for people who don't play, that's not perhaps the most.
Yeah, for you guitar players and piano players and such, it's great. For us B flat players, it's in C sharp.
Right.
What was I thinking? But you know, it's. I guess I'd always written like most of the other kind of Latinish Afro Cuban tunes. They always end up being in minor keys.
Sure.
So or at least the ones I write always end up being. But this is one of those things where I heard this melody. I'm like, okay, cool. Jot it down, and then once you're out of the creative element, you're like, holy shit, it's in B.
Mm-hmm. Here it is. right.
All right, well, get yourself together.
Yep.
and deal with it.
Sorry, bass players.
So I'm really proud of that song.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think it represents so much of your music, of this like this playfulness, but also in like you were referencing earlier, these references to the tradition, right? The evolution and tradition of music.
Right.
But it's also like it's somebody who's really studied their horn, their parts. You know, it sounds very like here's your samba, but it's really cool and hip. You know,
yeah,
like
you.
That. You know, like,
you know. Thank you. I mean, it's you know, I try to be as, or at least with us, I'm trying for us to be as organic or and again, it was the idea behind the band. It was never so much about just me. I never wanted it to just to be me plus three other people.
Yeah.
I wanted it to be a band. I mean, I wanted to, you know, and I want everybody in the band to have as much say over the arrangement as well as just like, you know, it's a four-way dialogue on stage.
Yeah.
You know? I'd like to think that's, I don't want to say that's missing around here, but at the very least, I think that's what we're known for. I mean, we're known, people, one thing people have always said about is like, I appreciate that you guys are a band. Like, I appreciate the fact that, you know, I'll see you, you know, I'll see you today and I'll see you 3 months from now. A, it'll be the same four people, but also the song will sound completely different, you know, and just the fact that we're hopefully evolving as musicians, but just, you know, whatever we've been working on will sound differently. We'll sound like different players.
Yeah.
Hopefully, so.
Well, it's such a, like, you know, like we were saying earlier, it's such a unique thing. I think particularly like as adults, like you were mentioning The Truth, and like any band that you form in high school, you're going to have this organicness because you're all still figuring out how to play your instruments and like the same things kind of going on where you live, like the music you guys are all generally listening to and this type of thing. And then when you're a working musician and an adult, like everybody kind of comes from somewhere else. They're all listening to different things. They're all gigging with 14 other bands and that type of thing. And
right.
That's a pretty unique situation. Like it's really cool to hear that, you know?
Yeah. And it's funny because it's funny you mentioned Truth. Like, I mean, obviously, you know, I'm a musician and I need to make a living and all that kind of thing. But I never want to lose that like playful spirit. That kind of, back when I was playing with Truth and like a couple years after when I was really kind of getting myself together and coming out on the scene, you know, you're playing. You know, you want to make some money, but at the same time, you're kind of oblivious to the whole like making a living thing and whatever. You know, super important.
Sure.
Your wife and kid at home, diapers ain't cheap.
That's right. Well, your status of living changes too, from like when you're 22 and then older. Yeah, you know, right.
I got, you know, he's going into preschool. My son's going into preschool this year, so I need, you know,
yeah,
gotta
pay those bills.
Gigs,
everyone's gotta eat.
Gotta, you know, all that stuff. You know. But at the same time, I don't want to lose that playful spirit of playing. Whatever it was that I had at, you know, 17, 18, 19 when I started playing, I try not to lose that.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's just important to hold on to that because it's, you don't want to get so cynical about, you know, everything else and clubs closing and blah, 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 and audiences and this. You know, you just don't want to get so cynical about all that stuff that you just, you know, we both know people like that that have, I don't want to say been on the scene too long, but they've been disappointed a lot. And I never wanted to be one of those people. I always wanted to, you know, I want to at least keep some kind of playful spirit.
Yeah, enjoy what you, I mean, you get to play the saxophone.
I get to play for
almost every day of the week,
right,
if not every day of the week, right?
I get to play and music and somebody will hand me some money, and most of the time I play, even if I didn't play everything that I wanted to play, I know that I got another chance tomorrow to do better.
Exactly.
So, you know, I just, it's hard to get too upset about this. I think about, you know, if I'm rambling.
No,
you know,
this is the whole point of this.
I think about this all the time, and this has been my analogy lately. Like, I say this all the time. Whenever I get frustrated, my wife and I'm going to say 5-6 years ago, we were at the Aaron Water show, and we're looking at, and I think we're just getting ready to leave, and the Blue Angels come on, and the Blue Angels, they're doing their, you know, flying at each other and pulling, you know, going in two different directions and flying, the cockpits are 2 inches away from each other and just doing all this flight, really cool flight squadron stuff. And I'm just looking up thinking, you know what? If they mess up, they die.
That's right.
If I play a bad soul, so what?
Yep.
You know,
no one dies.
No one. I can.
Three people maybe notice. Maybe even not.
Right.
Exactly.
If I have a bad day. No, whatever.
Yeah, you're not operating on someone. You know, it's not heart surgery.
I'm not flying
that 15 or whatever. Yeah, exactly. Right.
I'm playing the saxophone.
Right.
I'm not Well, I'm not pointing a $50 million jet at another $50 million jet.
Yeah.
You know.
No.
So so that's why I just can't get too... I shouldn't get too upset about
it. No, you shouldn't. And I don't, you know, from knowing you and having watched you in other groups and that type of thing, like, again, just it is a unique situation to be someone who's as busy working as you are and yet bring 150% to every project you work on, even though, you know, even if it is the kind of bullshit, we're playing over a record in Nowheresville, Ohio type of thing. I didn't see that gig, but knowing Chris Green and having been on some other strange gigs maybe with you, you know, it's you can't tell that, you know, and I think that is actually a fairly unique thing amongst some working musicians, you know. There's a lot of people who are like, well, this is my bullshit gig, but my real gig's on Thursday night at the Hungry Brain. And,
right.
You know, yeah.
No, it's just I think once you start down that path of condescending towards a gig,
mm-hmm.
you know, you run the risk of always condescending that towards gigs.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. It's fine to be, you know, occasionally dark about a few things or just, you know.
Have some perspective on what's
right,
going on.
Have some
yeah.
perspective or make some jokes or whatever like that. You know, it's fine.
Sure.
You know, and every once in a while you'll play a gig, you know, you'll be at a gig that you're making a decent amount of money for, like some jobbing gig, and
mm-hmm.
you're playing, I'm trying to think, Don't Stop Believing for like the umpteenth time, and,
yep.
and then all of a sudden there's a conga line, and you're like, "Oh boy,
this is what I spent all these years practicing for." Yeah.
I really hope my son appreciates this. I really hope when he's in the best
college of all time,
right? Yeah, when he's going to Harvard.
That's right.
I really appreciate it. I hope he appreciates this. But again, you know, and so it's fine to do that, but not all the time. And I guess if you start on that like dark, cynical shit, then it's, you know, then where do you stop?
Yeah, what's the point then, right? I mean, you're never gonna,
right?
You know,
so, you know, so, you know, have fun with it. Like I said, even with the gig I was telling you about where
yeah.
we were in Ohio, and like I said, I was playing with two other great horn players. Like I said, the music wasn't happening, but like I said, everything was fun, everybody got along. You know, I've been on gigs where, you know, the music was happening and stuff, you know, there were weird tensions in the band,
mm-hmm.
and not necessarily with me, with just other people in the band that affected everybody else.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt.
So, you know, so that you know, so you know, you every gig is different. Every gig is going to be different, and every situation is going to be different. So,
mm-hmm.
I'm just lucky that I'm in a situation with a band that where we all get along, and
yeah,
you know, I would like to think I'm not a micromanager. I'm probably perhaps a macro manager. Which is fine,
but there almost has to be. I mean, it, you know, I think it's so easy for perhaps people who don't play to have this like illusion that it's always a democracy or it's always this like socialist regime of
right.
like we're all writing the songs together and we're all booking the gigs together and we're all showing up on time to sound check together. And
right.
no, there's usually one, maybe two, but usually one person that's sort of the
right.
ringleader, right? And
right, exactly.
Be, yeah,
yeah, yeah. There's got to be the guy that. Books the gig or gets it right. The guy's crazy enough to talk to the clone and say, I've got this band and
yeah.
you should book us.
Totally,
well,
right.
Well, why? Why should we book you?
Because we're really good.
We're really good. You know, so it's got to be that guy. That's going to be me. I'm going to be that
mm-hmm.
crazy guy.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. And it's cool to have that too because, you know, I think the flip side to all that is that, like, you know, when you're only just a working musician and you're only just gigging all over the place, you can't always get those moments of like, I'm enjoying playing with these three people and we're making great music, you know
yeah.
what I mean? But you seem to find a good balance of like booking your own gig, your own band pretty consistently and also playing every other single club in Chicago.
Yeah, you know, yeah, or at least, you know, and every club is, you know, every situation is different. Like we'll play, like we get to play like some of the bigger rooms or whatever, or I should say that big, the more listening rooms, like say the Green Mill or whatever,
sure.
where it's about listening there or the showcase. And then there are other places like we play at Pete Miller's where the focus isn't necessarily on the music per se as it is just kind of like keeping a vibe and
right, the ambiance behind it.
Keeping
and
the ambiance.
Yeah.
But, you know, the challenge for us then is like, how do we keep that vibe and not play too loud and still make it musically interesting for us.
Yeah.
And so that's always a challenge for us. But I think we've managed to at least keep that going just 'cause that we've been there for a minute.
Yeah.
So But you know, every gig is different. Every gig is going to be a little different. Every situation is going to be different. There are challenges with every gig. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I enjoy that.
Yeah, and what's and I mean, it's interesting. You know, I feel like there a majority of a lot of people play those types of background jazz gigs, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, because there's always a restaurant that needs somebody. There's always, you know, at the movie theater in Evanston, they got a jazz club there, and you know, and it's awesome, and like some of the most exciting musical moments can really happen there.
Yeah, exactly.
But then what's it like then crossing over to places like the Green Mill and Jazz Showcase and not playing, you know, just a list of standards, but getting to play your own compositions with people sitting and listening and watching? Like,
you know, I always make the joke. When I play, like, you realize, I always tell the audience, you realize you all are throwing me off by your attention.
Yeah, right.
Like, if you all want to pull your cell phones out or just randomly, drunkenly walk up to us and yell us a request or something, or you know, if y'all just want to talk right in front of us, feel free.
It's totally cool, man.
This attention, this focus on us is throwing us off. So I, you know, it's funny you should mention. Like, I told my wife when we first got together, and I had like that had to play a private gig, and she it blew her mind. She's like, "Let me get," I'm probably going to let a huge secret out of the bag for musicians. I apologize to every musician out there. But she asked me, like, let me get this straight. They're paying you a bunch of money to play music that they're going to ignore? I was like, yep.
That's exactly what is that.
Like, why would they do that? Yeah. Where they could just have an iPod. I was like,
No.
Like, don't let them...
That's right. That's right. That's right.
You know, and I just,
who else would take advantage of that open bar if they didn't book a band?
Right, right. It just blew her mind. It's like, why would they hire you? Hey. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you want me to keep coming?
That's right. Somebody's got to pay for this car ride over here, right?
Do you want me to keep coming up with my half of the rent?
Exactly. Right. That's right.
You know. So it's just fun. So you know, but it's all. I like, you know, it's always good to play. It's good to play both, but I mean, obviously you would love to be in a position where you're playing in more places where you're the focal point of attention. You know, hopefully we'll get there. And we've been playing a lot more of those lately.
Yeah, that's right.
But again, but on those gigs that people aren't paying attention, those are actually the gigs that we can actually bring new stuff. If I can't get everybody together for a rehearsal because we're all four busy musicians, mm-hmm. then I can, on those gigs where people aren't paying as much of attention, I can sneak a new tune in or change an arrangement of another tune that we're doing, and then by the time it gets to a gig that we're, you know, that we're the focal point of attention, it's like it's had its chance to get workshopped.
Right, you've road tested it and everything too. Yeah.
So
yeah. And it's cool, like, sometimes the audience, too, it's like, you know, it's of course, playing for the people who are coming to listen.
Of course.
Specifically for yours is amazing, and a lot of those people are aficionados, and they know what's going on. But then connecting with, like, you know, people who were just at a party, and they're like, oh, wow, this band is really great. And they're, who are you? What, you know,
you
like
know, this. And that's, I'm glad you brought that up. I was actually in the middle of a Facebook discussion about this kind of, this, that very thing. Like, the thing to remember is that the majority of the people that come to see us or most jazz bands aren't jazz aficionados.
That's right.
They may have a jazz record or two. They may own Kind of Blue. They may own the latest Diana Krall album.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, they're not jazz aficionados, which is fine. Which is actually fine. And those are the people that, like, you know, you play, you hit them with your most intense stuff. Those are the people that are like, wow, like, I thought that jazz was just my grandfather's music.
Exactly, right.
I didn't realize it was like live and
exciting
and vital and part of, you know, could actually be applicable to 2014. And those are the people that hopefully will follow you from club to club. So, you know, I don't know. So it just, yeah, I don't know. There's just infinite possibilities, I think, with that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to another track from your guys' newest album. This is Molar Melancholia, or Melancholia, depending where you're from. Anything you want to say about this beforehand? Or?
Well, I'll say that this was a song inspired by my son. He was a pretty awesome kid, awesome infant, up until the point where he started teething.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't really cry much when we brought him home. not a lot of sleepless nights. But when he started teething, that's pretty much when all bets were off. So that's more or less what this song was inspired by. It was inspired by his misery, my shared misery, because I was up with him, and my discovery of bourbon.
Wonderful. So Molar Melancholia, Chris Green Quartet. From the Chris Green Quartet, from their latest album, Music Appreciation, a double album, bold choice.
A double album in 2014,
a jazz double album. Chris Green does nothing.
A self-released double album.
That's right. Well, it's interesting, you know, and it was just actually, I just caught this on, you're so active on social media and have so many cool discussions on there. I noticed yesterday, I think it was yesterday, you guys were having a discussion on is it worth it to release albums anymore? Or are we living in an age anymore where viable to release an album, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's fun, and one of the guys that chimed in was my guy, Joe Todorici, the producer, our producer. That's a good question. You know, I think there will always be a need for albums.
Yeah, no, I do too.
If only because when you're playing a gig and you're, you know, for whatever reason, you hit the audience's sweet spot or whatever, and then, like, you know, whatever you did that night, you guys are great. I gotta have your album.
You want to take it home, right?
You know,
yeah.
You know, and that's it's important to have those physical copies on it. You know, and I learned, at least from the very early days of having bands, where, like, you would play and, oh my god, I'll buy whatever you have. Like, I don't have an album.
I don't have anything to sell you, but
yeah, and, like, you know, and
if you go to my website and then type in this code and then you can download it and then put it on your phone, you can do that. You know,
not even.
Yeah,
well,
but
I mean, back, we're talking like mid-90s.
Oh, sure,
like,
yeah.
Where, like,
you have a cassette tape or something. Yeah, anything.
Well,
yeah,
I had cassette tapes, and the websites had all those, like, little flashy.
That's right.
had all the little gnomes and all kinds of
stuff.
Yeah,
the GeoCities.
Right, exactly. So there was, you know, so there's no real way to sell anything, but so there's that connection.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And then there are people out there. I mean, granted, it's important to me as a band leader and I guess a businessman or whatever you want to say, like, to have your music out in every kind of format. So, like, I would prefer that they buy the physical copy for me, or that they buy it through, say, our Bandcamp page, where you get, like, a little video with us, mm-hmm. with the album. But, you know, with some people, it's just like, you know what, I gotta go to, I know iTunes, I buy all my stuff through iTunes,
right?
Okay,
I'm on the train all the time, I'm just listening on my phone,
right? Exactly.
Yeah,
it's easier for me to go to iTunes, where I have an account, versus, you know, this...
Right, buying the vinyl copy and vinyl listening copy at home and then putting it on my...
What's this, Bandcamp?
Exactly, right.
Or Dusty Groove, where's that place?
Exactly.
Is that a good neighborhood? You know, so, fine. You know, so, yeah. You know what? So, sale is a sale, and if they like it, cool. You know?
And they have it. And it's...
And they have it, right.
And it's a document, too, right? Like, and I think that's...
Right.
Such a cool...
You know, and
in 20 years, you're going to, you know, your son's going to listen to this and know that this is what the Chris Green Quartet sounded like
right.
at this period in time.
Exactly. And I don't know. And at the end of the day, like, you know, I'm not Eminem or Alicia Keys or whatever. I make CDs so that one day I can make more CDs.
Yeah.
You know, that's my goal to kind of like keep it going. I have no illusions about like making a living from making CDs because you know that's fortunately I love to play live and I love to I teach a little bit as well so I enjoy those things so fortunately those things are happening so I don't the CDs are a document but they're like I said they're a way to connect.
That's
with your audience.
Yeah, and they can listen to it. They can talk about it. They can know it.
Right.
And it's kind of cool when they're familiar with your music enough,
exactly.
or just enjoy it enough to listen to it in a place. You know, maybe I'll never see these people again, but
right, exactly.
They're in town for one night and they're driving to Cleveland and they're going to listen to
exactly.
it or whatever.
You know,
yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. We're talking with Chris Green of the Chris Green Quartet, and they're playing every Thursday, at least through the end of August, at Pete Miller's in Evanston, which is a great, great restaurant.
Yep.
And they're also playing August 6th at Jazzin' at the Shed, so you can catch them there as well.
Yes.
The other thing that we do on this show is we ask everybody to bring in an album or talk about an album that's important to them in some regard. And it always seems to be a really challenging... I've gotten a few threats from people. They're like, why are you making me choose one? You know, and it is hard, but it's interesting because it's everybody who's brought something in. Including yourself, as you know, it really speaks a lot. And you brought in "Roots Revisited" by Maceo Parker.
Yes, I was going to bring "Life on Planet Groove"
right.
by Maceo Parker, which I would say is as far as the way I play, just the way I approach music, like that's one of those albums. Like, if I hadn't heard that album, I wouldn't be here talking to you. It's
yeah.
like that. It's like that integral to. What it is I do and how I play, but I think what got me started on at least learning about Maceo Parker and just kind of his contribution to like what he like saxophone and funk and everything else, like his first album Roots Revisited, or I should say his maybe not his first. He'd had a band in the 70s called Maceo and the King's Men, which was when he left James Brown's band the first time.
Right.
He had a band and they played locally and they made some in the early 70s. They made some noise, but they didn't make enough noise, and so Maceo ended up going back and staying with James for another 5 years until he jumped ship again and then joined Parliament Funkadelic and played with them for a long time. But this was like his first official solo release,
mm-hmm.
and it was like it was on Verve Records, which I think had been recently resurrected, and he'd got it was the horn section was Fred Wesley, the great Fred Wesley,
yeah.
Arranger and leader of James Brown's bands, and Pee Wee Ellis, who was the leader and arranger of James Brown's band before Fred Wesley, so you had all that. You had like. I want to say Don Pullen was playing organ, and who else was playing? I don't even remember. Bill Stewart was playing drums, and so you had this kind of this cross section of jazz musicians and people that played funk, but it was one of those albums that hit me at the right time. I think it was right about the time. That I'd gotten serious about playing,
mm-hmm.
I finally realized, okay, this is what I want to do. And I applied to music school, and I got accepted to Indiana, and I was getting ready to study there. And at the same time, like parallels all that, like, or at least leading up to that, I should say, like I was, it was a huge hip hop fan, growing up in the late '80s, early '90s. And of course, this was the golden age of hip hop where everybody was sampling everything and didn't have to credit anything for it. So, you know, everybody was, 98% of everybody was, some form or shape of whatever was, everybody was sampling James Brown.
Right.
So once I kind of got serious about playing music and taking these theory classes and could actually like sort of kind of hear the science behind everything I'd been playing, I think I was listening to, I want to say what used to be called, it was back in, there was a show called The Rap Down.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you remember The
Rap? Yeah, yeah, totally.
So it was Mamonski Love and Disco Dave, and they this one night, for whatever reason, they were playing songs that had sampled Funky Drummer. I'd heard that break for years and years and years.
Right.
But then they actually played the original song, and then with the break and all, and it was just like, oh my, wait, so that wasn't actually part of these rap songs?
That's right. Yeah, this was its own thing.
This
beforehand.
Was actually its own song.
Yeah,
and it's just James. Wait a minute, James Brown. All I knew about James Brown was the I Got You and that horrible piece of shit Living in America.
Song. Right, right. Rocky Four.
Right. Yeah. So I'm like, wait a minute, you mean there's more to this dude than just those songs?
Oh my God, totally.
And wait, really?
Yeah.
And then it was just like, oh, okay, all right. And then like, so they were playing like, for whatever reason, they were, and so like, and my dad was huge into like funk and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, and I think he'd been trying to tell me about James Brown for years, and I was just kind of like, whatever, dude. Living in America.
Yeah, I listen to real music, okay?
I've heard all I need to hear.
Exactly, right.
You know, dancing behind Apollo Creed, I've heard enough.
Right, right. Know. Ivan Drago and all. Yeah, exactly.
So then you know, you kind of like, well, wait a minute. So then you hear like, you know, Papa Don't Take No Mess, which was sampled mm-hmm. on this song, and
yeah,
whatever. I'm trying to remember. You know, the stuff from the Black Caesar soundtrack, which was sampled on this rap song. So there's all the stuff that I'd already heard in, you know, people rhyming over.
Yeah.
Like, I'd actually heard hearing these James Brown songs, I actually heard the real songs. And so it's funny, like, my graduation present, my mother thought I was crazy. She's like, do you want a car? Or do you want blah, blah, blah? I was like, no. You know what I want? I want the James Brown Star Time box set.
Wow.
Which had just come out. She's like, you don't want a car? You know? Yeah. Nope.
I want to sit in my room and listen to this.
I want 6 hours of James Brown music on cassette.
Uh-huh.
And so it, like, just going through that album and just listening to all that stuff, and so like, it was literally like, oh, that's what that sample's from.
Right.
That's what that's from. Mm-hmm. That's what that's from. And then, okay, so then, you know, you're listening to all that stuff, and then, you know, he's known for his horn section, and then, you know, the two kind of dominant voices in the horn section that come out are like, you know, the Maceo Parker,
right,
and Fred Wesley. And I'd heard him play before. I'd heard him play, you know, he did the solo on various songs, but he, you know, his most famous song was the little break on I Got You.
Yeah.
But then, you get in this deeper in the James Brown stuff, you hear like these extended solos on like Cold Sweat and Funky Drummer and all these other songs. And so I'm like, okay, all right, this guy's got a cool thing happened. And again, this is like parallel to like me trying to get my stuff together with like Coltrane and Bird, and at least trying to incorporate that in mm-hmm. what I'm doing at like 17 or 18. And then, like, of all things, and I was actually just thinking about this today, there's a review for this album, Roots Revisited, in People Magazine, which is funny today because like People Magazine is like super tabloid.
Exactly, right. They're not getting into like the, you know the obscurity of,
if it ain't Kim Kardashian or kind of whatever kind of shit, they're, you know, they're not trying to hear it. But for whatever reason, in the late 80s and early 90s, they were actually like reviewing like real music. Like they were reviewing Prince albums and like Steve Coleman albums, and like Steve Coleman had a review in People Magazine of all, you know, so they actually reviewed this album. You know, Maceo Parker steps out with his solo debut, and you know, he's known with playing, you know, Parliament Funkadelic and playing with James Brown and everything. And again, I'm trying to get my stuff together. I'm trying to learn all,
right.
all, whatever, anything saxophone, it's like, okay, cool.
I want to be part of this, yeah, yeah.
This, I need to check this out. So I bought this, and it's just like, you know, it pretty much set me on a path, because it's like, it was the first time, it was, at least to my ears, it was the first time that a saxophone player had kind of approached his saxophone as like a rhythmic instrument.
Yeah.
More than, and of course you could analyze, you know, we knowing what I know now, you can analyze any of the greats, and you could see like any of the greats that we listen to are all like pretty rhythmic. But at least at the time, coming from a guy that listened to lots of R&B growing up and hip hop and everything, mm-hmm. and was making the bridge between like this James Brown that I was dealing with, as well as you know, the hip hop that I was also dealing with. You know, this guy was kind of like he was very rhythmic in his saxophone playing. So that kind of got me as well. But what also got me, again, my burgeoning interest in trying to play jazz. Here's a guy who's not really known for playing jazz, but he's got like a Charles Mingus tune, mm-hmm. and a Jay McShann tune, but then he's also playing a Curtis Mayfield tune as well, and then I think the very last song is he's got like Bootsy Collins playing bass,
right?
So it's just, you know, it's so just kind of like this one of those albums. It's like, you know, he's cognizant of his place in history, but also letting you know that this is just kind of the beginning, and I'm gonna, you know, you're gonna see some stuff down the road.
So. Yeah, because then he has this huge career that continues, right? I mean, he's playing with Prince for the last 20
years,
exactly.
Right?
You know, right,
exactly. And so, you know, you can imagine my delight as a Prince fan.
Yeah.
You know, and one of my favorite saxophone players is playing with him. It's just, you know, when I went to see him, like, you can imagine my delight.
Yeah.
But it's also just really, you know, it's really cool to see, like, an older guy like him get his overdue props.
Absolutely, you know? Right, right.
So that was cool. You know, so again, I guess it was just something that I could, it was something that I could relate to. Like, I could, because of, like, the high school theory classes, at least, you know, my 17-year-old whatever brain, I wouldn't say that I necessarily had the intellectual capacity to understand what John Coltrane was doing,
mm-hmm.
but I had the curiosity to like find out what he was doing.
Right.
This, at least with the Maceo album, at least was like I could not necessarily that I could do what he's doing, but it was definitely like it was a bridge between where I was, the stuff I was listening to, and where I wanted to go.
Yeah. He's this great entry. I mean, I was mentioning right before we started, I was re-listening to Life on Planet Groove,
mm-hmm.
and I remember being 17 years old, and, you know, you got to this point where, you know, if you could sort of hang, the older drummers called you over at one point, and I learned this, I wasn't the only one, but they were like, all right, man, and they gave you the CD. It's like big pink cover on it.
Yep.
Like, take this home for 3 days and then you will understand funk. And I didn't even know I was going to... I didn't even know. And you listen to it, and it as a band leader, everybody in the band, the way he's leading the band and this type of thing. And, but yeah, I mean, like, it's just this whole... Well, you said this bridge between pop music, what you're listening to, what's going on the radio, mm-hmm. the history, the tradition. And I think it's, you know, it's easy to forget sometimes that all these guys were ex-jazzers, right? I mean, they were, all the Motown guys were jazzers who were, you know,
yeah.
paying the bills during the day playing some R&B songs.
Yeah.
And now we know all their licks from that. You know, mm-hmm. we know all the James Brown hits. We know all the...
Exactly. And I think, you know, the thing about, at least for me anyway, Maceo, he can hang on a jazz gig, but it's not what he's known for.
Right.
I mean, his style is just, it's so, it's such a, it's funny, like, like, it's almost like people like Maceo, or at least other saxophonists like him,
mm-hmm.
but it's almost like they don't want to admit it.
Right, it's so good, right?
Because, yeah. because it's so rhythmic and spare, and he's not like playing a bunch. He's not playing any unnecessary notes.
Mm-hmm.
He's just It's very rhythmic. It's very, you know, at least to my ears, he's thinking like a rhythmic instrument.
Yeah,
and it's just. And I've always liked that about him. So, and I guess it's, you know, and again, he's a guy that spent many years with James Brown and then spent another many years with the whole George Clinton enterprise. Right. Like those are two.
Those
like,
are two great grad schools to go
two,
to. Yeah,
two like dynasties of funk.
Yeah,
I'm like, you know, just at James, and not just George Clinton, like George Clinton at his peak.
Exactly right.
You know,
70s
like,
George Clinton.
Yeah,
right.
Like,
yeah,
just like he was there, and just like I can't imagine all the just everything he soaked up.
You're right.
And so now, you know, that's kind of all distilled in his solo album. And, you know, and again, I just appreciate the fact that like. Again, he's playing saxophone. He's playing saxophone with a distinctive style. He's playing some funkier stuff, but again, at the time it was my kind of I really started to get into jazz, and it's like, okay, not only is he playing this funky stuff, but he's actually playing like Mingus tunes,
right?
And you know, so and again, he's not making anybody forget like Charlie Parker or Kenny Garrett or anything, but he's hanging.
It comes from that tradition, you know. It's this. I saw you mentioned Pee Wee Ellis plays on this. I saw him a few weeks ago at City Winery with the Ginger Baker Jazz Confusion.
Right, I forgot he's playing with that.
And he's another guy where you know, like I've heard him with Maceo. I've heard him on Van Morrison records. Mm-hmm. I've heard him on you know all these pop records, and you know he's you know like Branford Marsalis too. Like you know him for these things, and you forget like oh you can really you can hang with the jazz guys too,
play.
Right? You know, yeah, yeah.
He can actually play, yeah. So you know, just it's just so it was kind of a breath of fresh air at the time because you know, again, I when I'm getting myself together and trying to learn how to play and you know kind of getting frustrated because you know I was you know in high school and then I go off to college and. You know, you've got people there that are walking around the practice room and you're hearing people warm up and you're like, oh man, I've made a huge mistake being here. This guy's playing stuff and I was the man in high school, but mm-hmm. here I'm just oh man.
And you went to Indiana University, yeah. Right? Which is like the number one music school in the country.
A pretty doggone good school. And right. I'm walking around the practice room listening to these people warm up. I'm like, oh boy.
Mm-hmm.
I need to transfer or something.
But it's, I mean, it's such a weird time for everybody, isn't it? Like, it's like, you know, and I guess all our forms are probably like this, but it's so interesting being in music school, and it's like, it's not just learning the tunes, it's getting really good at them and having them, like, drill all these things.
Right.
That you have to get drilled into at that age so that when you're older, you can use those and not think about it, but it's really humbling, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Especially, yeah. Like, you know, walking, like I said, as a freshman or whatever.
Yeah.
But again, this is just one of those albums that hit me the right time. It just like, you know, great musicianship, you know, some, accessible material, but, enough that a person, again, I guess like we talked about earlier, enough that a person that knows nothing about jazz or whatever, or music or whatever can get into it, and there's enough musical meat for musicians themselves. To get into as well. So
cool. Well, let's listen to a little bit of one of the tracks here. We'll listen to Better Get Hit in Your Soul.
Ah, the Mingus tune. Which, again, you know, I'd heard this before. I'd heard the original Mingus tune, the Mingus version. Of course, the Mingus version is better.
Sure, but it's interesting to hear how that composition transfers, isn't it?
But, you know, you gotta give the guy props for trying to play a Mingus tune.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's. I mean, that's such a challenging thing on any gig, right?
Absolutely.
And then to put the definitive stamp on it and say, I'm releasing this as an album. Here yes, you go.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, this is Better Get Hit in Your Soul, Maceo Parker. That'll get hit in your soul. Maceo Parker, Roots Revisited, one of the most important albums for Chris Green. Chris, thanks so much for coming in tonight. If you want to, if our listeners would like to check out more of your stuff, where can they go?
You can go to Chris Green Jazz, ChrisGreenJazz.com, or ChrisGreenQuartet.com. I'm on Facebook and Twitter and even that bullshit ass LinkedIn.
LinkedIn, yeah, sure.
Which,
yeah.
You know, all that stuff. So, you know, hit me up and you'll know where we're playing.
You'll find it. There's also a really good chance if you just walk in any club any Monday through Sunday in the Chicagoland area, you'll probably, and there's a saxophone player, you'll see Chris Green playing.
That, or at least, if I'm not on stage, I'll be at the bar.
It's just one of, yeah. Spoken like a true working musician. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.